The following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you can join us today. And before we get started, let's remind the listeners that you should not rush off and try any of the strategies that we may talk about or necessarily implement certain changes to your current modus operandi. You may be doing everything right. I don't know. But what I would really suggest you do is talk to your existing advisors. If you hear something that you didn't know or maybe you weren't sure about and you think, well, gee, that might apply to what I'm trying to do, and see what they tell you, because presumably they're familiar currently with your facts and circumstances and can tell you whether or not you understood correctly what you heard and how it might affect you. For those that don't have existing advisors, feel free to go to our website at baplanner.com. That's baplanner.com. And if you will complete at least the step one, form one, we'd like for you to complete them all. If they apply to you, the last form is for those that have a small business or might be a shareholder or partner in a partnership that they control. And that could be some vital information at some point. But again, if you'll do a minimum of the step one, form one, we can start there, and that'll give us enough background information on your current circumstances to at least have a phone call, and let's figure out if we can help you achieve your goals and objectives. Okay, well, let's look at a couple things in the news. Big talk, well, one of the areas of the big talk in Washington, the part that affects what we do for a living, which is consult with clients on tax policy and tax planning, etc., is the passage, I guess, both the House and the Senate have now adopted a budget, which was something that you may recall Mr. Trump was seeking to implement, and one big, beautiful reconciliation piece of legislation. And I tell you, more than a few of the members of the Senate, I believe, were the final adoptee, and they had to hold their nose to move through that process. And I take it back. The Senate adopted first. That was on April 5th that they agreed, and then the House came later on April 10th, and that is something that still has a little ways to go. I'm not sure how it's going to get scored. I think CBO still has to score it, and they're trying an interesting, well, it's not interesting, it's classic politics, where they're using a special budgetary trick of defining the way that the legislation is changing or not changing the increase in taxes by more than how much we're cutting the spending. And it's referred to, I believe they call it the current policy style or definition. Let me read for you here. Let's see. I got an email from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and we've talked about many of their issuances before, and it's kind of thrown them into a tizzy. But in any event, the budget's reconciliation instructions would allow for legislation to add $5.8 trillion to the current near $40 trillion deficit that we have now. And this would be added throughout over a period, rather, of all the way out through 2034, including a permanent extension of the expiring 2017 tax cuts that the TCJA, that would be the Trump tax legislation back from first administration, first time he was president, and it's using the current policy, quote-unquote, gimmick is what the CRFB calls it, and it only requires $4 billion, using this logic, this definition, it only requires $4 billion in gross deficit reduction again over the same period. Isn't it wonderful how Congress occasionally gets an appetite for cutting spending, and of course they always spend more than they cut. I've said that many times. That's the problem we have. It's not that we haven't cut taxes many times over the year and spurred additional tax collections by the government, but the problem is Congress would spend 3 and 4 times the amount that we took in, the additional tax revenues, so it never really cut the deficit. In fact, it's gone the other way. And but in any event, a package the size of what is being kicked around, or I guess getting kicked towards the finish line, would double the growth in debt to GDP. And again, GDP is that number that we compare ourselves to many other economies. We've got the biggest one. I think it's $27 trillion a year now, somewhere in that range. And but here's the critical part. It would push annual deficits to $3.4 trillion. That's annually, each year, by 2034. Currently, we're projected, according to the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, again, they project an average of about $2.1 trillion out through 2034. So this will be adding significant amounts to that already just insane number of debt. And, of course, the interest on the debt will skyrocket as well. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but let's just say right now, interest has slid into the third spot on the four largest components of our annual budget, our annual expenditure. And somewhere just over $1 trillion, $1.1 trillion, I believe, is what we ended up at the end of the fiscal year, ended this past September. But we'll be over that here on this year's budget, the year ending September 2025. But in any event, the idea that we can use these gimmicks in terms of, and I don't want to get into the difference between, you know, if current policy is option A and or option B, option A is our historical way of scoring these things. You can rest assured there's some funny business going on, and it's so frustrating because you know, and I'm sure we can justify everything that's in this additional $5.8 trillion that we're being asked, we will be asked to go on the hook for. I'm sure it's all valid and valuable. And I guess if we could find a way to cut $2 trillion or more a year, it wouldn't be as bad of a deal. It'd still be worse than, you know, what we're looking at from a year ago and prior years before that. But, you know, the amount of money, and it's interesting, I'm trying to think who I was watching. It may have been a Joe Rogan podcast, or maybe it was Jordan Peterson. One of them made the point that almost every government of any size is wasting, the estimate that they threw out was 50% of the government spending should be categorized as waste. And maybe you throw fraud in there as well, but, you know, I would certainly suggest that's likely the case in our situation. I mean, when you look at all these programs that have been uncovered, just in the realm of the USAID umbrella, with all the NGOs feeding so many of the members of Congress with what I'm going to call fake donations, and basically it's a circular equation where the congressman or congresswoman is voting for funding for USAID that in turn USAID, I would use the word, is gifting back to the congressperson and allowing them to use it for assorted things, travel, you know, living a life of relative luxury at the expense of the taxpayer when it comes to the gambits and other things they do with the money to enhance their hold on the office they hold and continue to seek. And it's just, and it's both parties. I think most of the funny business has been the Democrats so far, but you can rest assured they, as Elon Musk has already explained, there's Republicans involved. The Democrats are shrewd, and they made sure to pass out enough funds to the Republican brethren to where they will go along to get along. And it's tragic the way we've soaked the taxpayer, and still the debt just keeps going up. I mean, you would think it would bother somebody enough. You'd think we wouldn't have to bring an outsider in, or I guess maybe you wouldn't think. Maybe that is the way to uncover this type of thing. But I marvel at all the little pockets of waste that Mr. Musk and his team are uncovering. And, you know, that's we can do one of two things. We can either collect more or we can spend less. And I like the thought of spending less to get a big chunk of the revenues that we'd otherwise have to raise from the taxpayer. But anyway, let me read a little bit of the statement from the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Ms. Maya McGinnis. She's well known in the bipartisan tax policy opinion world. She said, "This budget sets the stage for the largest deficit increase in history." Now that's saying something. The largest deficit increase in history. An unprecedented bill that spends that requires just $4 billion in savings to offset up to $5.8 trillion in deficits. What an absolute disgrace. And this, Maya McGinnis is not a left-leaning, Democrat-persuaded government agency person. This is a nonprofit, a bipartisan nonprofit, true enough. But, it's still, she's not the bad guys. She's with the good guys. But as she says, what an absolute disgrace. The House instructions to allow $2.8 trillion of net borrowing after incorporating $2 trillion of gross spending cuts are bad enough, but it's the Senate instructions that are binding, not the House instructions. And that the instructions meaning as they proceed through getting this bill over the finish line and adopting, I guess, adopting either a real budget or more continuing resolutions. But it's the Senate instructions that are binding, not the House instructions, and certainly not some backroom commitment. The Senate took the House's borrowing allowance and more than doubled it, clearing the way for a bill that would borrow more money than the American Rescue Plan, TCJA CARES Act, and the bipartisan infrastructure laws combined. Now, that's saying something, because remember, the American Rescue Plan was what funded, I think there were altogether three economic stimulus payments for some people. Meanwhile, the Senate shrunk the House's required spending cuts by 99.8%. So here we're talking a good game leading up to votes, and that's when the sausage gets made, my friends. It says the Senate's required cuts equate to only $3 per household per year, enough to buy every American family a single cup of coffee. That's, as she said, an absolute disgrace. The House erred, or let's see, let me mention one other sentence here. Attaching such a debt blowout to the largest specified debt ceiling increase in history, $5 trillion, just adds insult to injury. The House erred in deferring to the Senate this time, and they must not continue to capitulate to them as we move forward. Fiscally responsible members of Congress should insist that the final legislation is fully paid for with substantial spending cuts and thoughtful tax return or tax reforms. Now, I could throw onto that. I mean, and again, I've said it before, I'm definitely rooting for Mr. Trump to monetize. There's several areas that we could see enormous amounts of receipts for the government that would overlay all of this potentially bad news or bad planning. We've got 14,000 empty office buildings, and that's not going to get you anywhere. It won't move the needle, but it's the concept of putting currently the assets that we have or we own that aren't generating cash flow, making them more efficient and selling them or renting them to the private sector, etc. That's one area. And that's probably the smallest. And then you've got the ANWR reserves and whatever else we have. We've got many oil and gas reserves that could be monetized and maybe do a public offering to accelerate the flow of the funds like Saudi Arabia did a few years back. And then we've got the cuts that Doge is uncovering by the day that I think most likely, I know the numbers that have been bannered about, $2 trillion is what I heard on the campaign trail. Now I'm hearing somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion for this year, and that's still substantial. That's wonderful progress towards what needs to happen. And then if you can repeat that on an annual basis, meaning we don't go spend it out the other door. Yeah, we collect it or cut it through one door, but Congress gets there. Congress thinks of cutting the amount we have to borrow as somehow that translates to new revenues for them to spend. And it's a tilted way of looking at a balance sheet. The concept of allowing more borrowing than the cuts is something that's just hard to swallow, because that's what's got us in trouble to date. I mean, for how many years now? The recent turmoil in the markets only serves as a reminder that the world, including our adversaries, who we borrow from, of course they borrow from us too. I think China holds half a trillion or more of our T-bills. But the world is paying attention to U.S. fiscal policy. There are real dangers that passing a debt increase this large could trigger a debt spiral and a fiscal crisis. Lawmakers should alleviate those fears by pivoting towards real, sustainable efforts to bring our long-term fiscal trajectory under control. One other thing that I failed to mention on the possibility of Mr. Trump working some magic to bring more revenues home are the tariffs. I think that kind of goes without saying, and I don't know whether it's going to be revenues from a tariff or whether it's going to be increased sales from factories that are built in our country and therefore provide jobs that pay employees that pay federal income tax. I mean, there's a number of ways that that scenario could play out and possibly will pay out. I don't think for a minute that he's got the intent, although he's a pretty good poker player, I don't think he has the intention of leaving these tariffs in place forever. But I think he's got the bully pulpit. He's got the hammer. And as a economy, we are the economy or the markets of choice for so many products. And so, you know, what's the old adage? He who has the gold sets the rules. And that's what Trump is doing. And why wouldn't he? Can you imagine if China or others held the rules, what they'd be doing? Look at what they're doing now, and they don't have the most attractive markets. And, you know, when you look at, I'll tell you who's got a really good explanation of what's going on with China is Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful is his nickname, with Shark Tank. I used to not have that good of impression of Mr. O'Leary, but I tell you what, after listening to him talk about tariffs, and this is a guy that's actually been on the firing line with China, and the way he explains how they have commandeered so many products from our small companies to where they rip them off, they either reverse engineer them or they simply take the blueprints from the factories in China that might already be producing them for the small American companies. They form new state-supported companies that then turn around, they make those same products, turn around and sell them back into the U.S. at 30 to 40% discounts, and there's really nothing that that U.S. company is allowed to do in terms of litigation against those Chinese companies. China just won't allow it, and, you know, it's hard to fathom that here we keep allowing that. For years, we've allowed the ripoff of our intellectual property. And it's like O'Leary says, he thinks a 400% tariff is a fair tariff for China. He said it's the only way we're going to get their attention, and this nonsense is going to stop. He pointed out something I wasn't aware of until I heard him discussing this recently, is that Chinese companies can list shares on our stock exchanges, and they don't report in GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. And the SEC, to date, has not enforced that requirement. It's required that you do that. And a lot of U.S. companies, probably almost all of them, spend millions of dollars a year trying to comply with those reporting rules. And to think that the Chinese company can compete with them for the same investor dollars and they don't have that layer of cost or that layer of culpability is just, it's inconceivable. I don't understand. Where are the people in government that are charged with Ryden heard on the reporting. You look at what they've gone after on other companies and company executives, et cetera, saying, well, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. This is like tantamount to out in the open fraud. How can this be overlooked? And according to Mr. O'Leary, he's already had this discussion with the incoming SEC chair. I believe he was just approved. Atkins is his last name. He was just approved this past week or two. And that's something to keep your eye on, because there's, I forget how much capital total. I believe it's about $800 billion in the capital of these Chinese companies that are trading on our exchanges that are guilty of these issues that Mr. O'Leary points out. Let's do this. Let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll circle back momentarily with more of this week's BIA Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and we've been talking about the sad state of affairs. I feel like I'm playing a broken record, or maybe it's Groundhog Day. It's I've been saying the sad state of our budgetary affairs, it seems like, forever, but in any event, there is hope, because whether we can get Congress to wake up and understand or not, we're going to come to a point probably 2028 to 2029 would be the time frame that it's likely we will have run out of the remaining portion of the discretionary budget that we have available based on our current tax collections and spending, although what we just discussed on this reconciliation bill will likely greatly accelerate that timeline. But anyway, under the current scenario that we're currently operating under, we're looking at 2028 to 29 on the early side, maybe 2030 if something were to allow us to stretch it out a bit. But when we can no longer pay 100% of the annual interest requirement on the U.S. debt, it's going to be very difficult to sell more T-bills. And our status as being really the only nation that can literally print money, that will probably no longer occur. And we would likely be in a depression worldwide, would be in a depression, the likes of which we've never seen, because we are, again, we are the market of choice in terms of consumption and many, many categories. And so, you know, if we don't do well, I believe it's a fair assumption that the rest of the country will not do well as will not do well either. So it's really amazing that, again, we don't have leadership that's driving this, and not just one or two people. I think, you know, the you're seeing more members in Congress talk about the issue. The president's certainly tuned in. Elon Musk is tuned in. He knows these numbers. He's probably one of the few people in government that's not an elected official that understands it. And, you know, when you look at the way we mentioned earlier, the U.S. aid spending, you know, what is it, $800 billion a year, I believe? It's some huge number. How in the world can we spend that kind of money? This is money we don't have. We're borrowing every penny of the funding that's going to some of the most ridiculous things that have nothing to do with our country's best interests. And, oh, I know you can argue that by giving money away to our enemies, they somehow become our friends or will take it easy on us if, you know, the missiles start flying. I don't buy that. And I would tell you, we want our enemies to live in fear and trepidation. We don't want them ripping us off by, you know, receiving money for some of the most amazing, quote, charitable purposes that have nothing to do with charity. They still hate us. And, you know, the people in Washington don't seem to understand that, you know, the way we disperse funds is so flawed to think that money is going to buy security. No, not unless it's spent on a strong military, then it'll buy security. But, you know, it's hard to fathom what's been allowed to happen. And it's just kind of, it's been kept under wraps. I mean, I am amazed at how much they've gotten away with, whoever they are. I think it's primarily the left side, the Democratic side of Congress. Although, again, I think, and even Mr. Musk has said as much, you've got the GOPs involved in some of those little honeypots as well. But in any event, you know, I think the writing's on the wall is all I'm trying to say in a nutshell. And if you're sitting here thinking that, oh, it's just all going to come out okay without you taking what might be some extraordinary steps between now and 2028, 29, or 30, I think you're going to be in for a shock. And one thing that we talk about almost every show that I'm going to mention again is the concept of converting your pre-tax retirement funds over to Roth. And now, if you're in investments that have kind of taken a dip, as have many, even in the real estate arena, but certainly in, you know, the public markets of stocks, bonds, mutual funds, etc., but even in the real estate private partnership market, the values have gone down because of the distress that the debt structures have caused. And the real distress is going to be here in the next, say, between now and the end of the year, is when I think you'll see record numbers of banks finally pulling the trigger on foreclosing or taking properties back instead of kicking the can down the road. And, you know, a drink of water there. My throat's getting sore. But you're going to see a record number of properties that the bank is going to say no more, either refinance or, and I don't mean refinance with us, refinance with somebody else, because most of these transactions that are in trouble have not been able to execute their original business plan because their interest rate started clicking up. 11 clicks upward is what the Fed caused or added over the 2 years there between beginning 22 and up into early 2024. But bottom line is, when your rate goes up that much, a rate like what somebody would normally do a rate like for the level, it isn't going to really help you. And I've seen a lot of good syndicators that had rate locks that was, a couple percent higher maybe than what they did the original loan at. And that just wasn't enough. And when you look at the impact on cash flow of having to fund that larger debt service, there's nothing there for the partners. In fact, you'll be lucky if there's enough there for the bank, you know, to get paid. And that's what has happened, and the banks have done a lot to try to help. I know some syndicators might disagree with that, but they could have moved to the end game a lot sooner than what it looks like they're getting ready to. And so we see transactions that are coming into the market that are people that kept their powder dry and have capital, and now they're going to make money at the expense of those that have already spent the money and have gotten to the end of the rope or end of their rope in terms of being able to commit any more capital. And, I'd be real careful as you look at transactions. Just because you're picking up a property at less than what someone else has spent, don't let that necessarily persuade you that that's a good deal. You're getting a low cost basis, et cetera. I hear it all the time. A syndicator will say, well, you know, we bought a property that the bank just valued at, you know, $4 million higher than what we paid for it. Well, you're likely not the only party circling, the only vulture, let's say, circling that carcass. And you probably got the deal because you offered more than the other vultures. And I'm using that term lovingly. But in any event, nobody's giving properties away. It's what I've learned. And you pay what the market, or you receive if you're the bank selling it, what the market will bear. In any event, there are deals to be had. There's no question. And if you understand the pro formas that are provided as part of the capital raise, and you understand the background of the syndicator involved and whether or not they've been able to successfully execute in the past, and hopefully through some hardship, you know, you learn what people are made out of when they have hardship. And far be it for you to invest in something that you know, the syndicator's never been to the finish line, has never navigated choppy waters when it comes to a number of things, you know, bad debt structures, bad contractor work, bad leasing staff work, where, you know, the pro formas didn't happen. You didn't perform the way that you projected. And what you do to correct that? And that's what you want to try to understand as a passive investor that's looking at putting your money into transactions. And essentially what we try to help our clients do is understand, at least mathematically, what they're signing up for. In other words, when we look at pro formas on a transaction, is the rental growth rate that's projected rational, given the location, given the age of the property, given the amount of money that's going to have to be spent to bring that property up to market and then perform a refinance or a sell to actually make money. And that's one of the reasons why we like multifamily projects better than single family. I mean, there's nothing wrong with single family in that it is, in many cases, a appreciating real estate asset, but the way it appreciates is by others in the market selling their property, comparable property, like in your neighborhood, and that is what dictates your top number that you can sell for. It's not like old apartment building that we might be able to buy, renovate it, and upscale certain of the amenities, bring them up to maybe not identical to what the new properties are offering, but you make it much more competitive. And you can do that typically at a much lower cost than building from the ground up, building new. And so, you know, I can buy an old Class C apartment building and spend a reasonable amount of money per unit on making it nice and turn around and you know, release at higher rates generally because now it's nice and shiny. And by getting that net operating income up, that creates value, and it's not limited or capped by what the apartment next door might have sold for. It's based on your net operating income. Different concept altogether than single family. And I know I've got clients that do single family. I've got clients that do flips and wholesales. And of the three of those, I definitely take the single family buy and hold assets in the right locations. But nothing compares to multifamily projects when you look at how we make money. And a multifamily asset is so much more appealing in terms of especially the passive angle to investing in real estate. You know, when you invest in a multifamily, a syndicated, you know, 200 to 800 unit apartment building with another 150 to 200 investors like yourself, and you're not the lead partner, well, you've got a lead partner that's the one responsible for finding the property, you know, putting a partnership together to raise funds. I mean, not just finding the property, but doing a certain level of due diligence on it to determine whether or not it can be successful and what kind of money would have to be spent to make it successful, bring it up to market, and then be able to refinance it. And effectively, that syndicator or that sponsor or lead partner, those terms all refer to the same role, they, again, are responsible for choosing the property, performing the due diligence, arranging for the acquisition, including undertaking the necessary debt placement, that's finding the loan. You don't go do that as a passive. And then they also undertake the equity raise where they're connecting with people like you as a passive investor that has money you can invest. And then further, the syndicator or sponsor, lead partner, etc., is then tasked with managing the ongoing operations of the partnership and its assets throughout the existence of that partnership. And it's a different way, you know, whereas when you buy a single family, I mean, yes, you could have a management company involved, but you're still going to be front and center when it comes to financing, when it comes to refinancing, when it comes to deciding who and how and where to hire a management company, unless you're planning on doing work yourself, which, you know, that's not the reason we invest in real estate. We like passive real estate. But in any event, the ability to do what most people would find, what I'm going to say is more enjoyable in life as you get into retirement, that's multifamily. And again, you know, single family's great. Good luck to you, and you know, you will probably reach a point at some juncture where you realize you'll maybe hearken back to these words. And I know I've got clients that like to travel and do other things where it takes them out of town, and you know, the ability to live that lifestyle with multifamily is much more of a likelihood. In any event, pivoting back to the tax discussion, so I started down the path of talking about your pre-tax retirement funds and considering a Roth conversion, whether your funds are invested in the stock market or invested in real estate private partnerships, or you want to invest in real estate private partnerships with those funds, you can certainly consider the Roth conversion. The beauty of the real estate private partnership asset is that asset is valued differently in terms of the tax base that you're going to pay the Roth conversion tax on to convert to Roth. And in fact, you don't even have to sell the investment to get there, nor do you if it's invested in the stock market. You have the end of business value that you use, but in the real estate private partnership market, that's considered to be a private company. And to value private companies, we have assorted discounts that the IRS allows on these types of valuations, whether it's a gift that you might do to your heirs, or whether it's a family limited partnership scenario you're transferring assets into. There's a whole set of rules, court cases, statutes that govern how you value private ownership interest. And you get the benefit of discounts involving the fact that you can't just go sell those assets typically. You certainly can't do that with the real estate private partnership interests that you will receive if you invest money in them. In fact, in the operating agreements of these partnerships, it's very clearly spelled out that you cannot transfer your ownership except under very, very limited situations where you are given, you have to request approval, and the lead partner typically might allow it if it rises to a level that they deem permissible. But generally speaking, you are locked down. You can't go sell it on any stock exchange. And so as a result, you get discounts, big discounts in the valuation. You also will never be in a situation where you control one of these partnerships that you might invest in real estate as a passive investor. And so you get a nice discount for that inability. You can't outvote the lead partner or any of your cohorts. And then there's assorted other discounts excuse me, that arise due to things like the economy, The debt market is one that I mentioned earlier. You know, you may not be able to refinance when your projections show that you can. You may not be able to rent all of your units in the timeline that you think you can. You may not be able to complete the rehab. You've got a whole raft, 20 to 25 risk factors that most real estate private placement memorandums disclose. And disclosures of this nature are mandated under the SEC's crowdfunding statute, which is how most of these transactions are offered to the investors. And so the benefit is that, as opposed to putting, let's use round numbers, $100,000 investment into Apple stock, you know, Apple, unless it has a precipitous dip in value, which it happens, I guess, look at the last couple of weeks, right? It does happen, but you got to be Johnny on the spot to catch that real time. Whereas in these real estate private partnerships, there's a more gradual value increase. You know, initially when you buy into them, you're looking at some time before the NOI becomes stable, and you've got an occupancy level that's stable that would allow the resulting value to start heading upward. But you know, the reality is, even if it heads upward, you've still got most of the risk that are identified at the outset. You still can't go sell your investment. You still can't go outvote. So there's a healthy discount regardless of how far into the transaction you are. And again, you don't have to sell it. We value it, and then you pick up an amount of income based on that reduced value on your 1040, your tax return for that year. And then at that point, assuming you're using an IRA or a solo K, then you've got the asset moved into the Roth side of those accounts. And tax-free money, qualified, but tax-free for the rest of your life. So do we care if taxes go up? Do we care if, I mean, we do care to the point that we want to make sure people can still rent our apartments, but everybody's got to have a place to lay their head. And this is an area that the planets have aligned in terms of being highly tax efficient with above average cash flows. Okay, we're at the end of the show. We're glad you could join us today. We will be back on Sunday with the Be a Planner cyber version, 7 a.m. right here on 700 a.m. KSEV. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.